and oh, sorry about that. Damn straight. I'm Samuel Trapp. I'm still learning. Sorry. I'm here live in the Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Art Studio. That's where I am. If you like to call in, please do. 573-746-8020 is the number. And I'd be happy to chat with you about all kinds of things. I've had an interesting day, extremely. I got about 50 tabs pulled up. I had a lot of stuff I wanted to talk about, and I probably will reiterate some of the things that I talked about last night, because Sunday I anticipate a pretty big show. Pretty big. Oh, and maybe I should call it the pretty big shoe. So it seems to me that somebody else is calling their shoe that. I don't know. Maybe I won't. But anyway, I anticipate a pretty big show on Sunday night with a lot of different topics. Everybody knows my complaints about the legal system, and I told you, outlined to you last night that I am not alone, that I want to hear your stories too about the overreach of government, and it's rampant in a lot of places, in a lot of Missouri places. It is rampant, and mine, you know, I've told you all about, and again, I encourage you to go back and listen to the July the 3rd episode that I put out fire. If you go to my website, which is internationalflavor.com, I want to give a couple of dates for shows that I believe are important to go back and listen to, perhaps in preparation for what I intend to do on Sunday, because I also have been looking into how other people are getting boned. And it's not just me. There are a lot of people that get boned by government. And so last night's episode got was pretty well received, and there was a bunch of stuff on there. You know, I like to talk about international things, and thus the name International Flavor. And here at International Flavor, we still give the news and the news of the day, only here it tastes better. Because I'm correct 99% of the time. Ah, maybe only 98%. All right, let's not go that far, but I do want to talk about it. I think that in keeping with my shoe, you should go back and listen to the episode from Sunday, July the 13th, the one that I call The Cheerleaders of Justice and the Missouri Bar's Dirty Secrets, and, you know, the scams that they pull on the Client Security Fund and Fee Dispute Resolution Committee and judicial selection, all of that. I think it's a scam. It's a joke. People haven't paid as much attention to it as they should. And there is, frankly, no need for it anymore. Now, remember this judicial selection thing that they give to us, and they always call it the nonpartisan. We have to throw in that word because, you know, if you say it often enough, it must be nonpartisan. So if you can claim it's nonpartisan, if you can claim your disinformation is Russian disinformation, you can kill two birds with one stone, right? So if you say it's nonpartisan and you get to select the judges with no input from any source whatsoever, They don't have to get past any voters. They don't even have to get past anybody that's been properly appointed. It's nonsense. And it's they claim that you needed this because that we, the state of Missouri, needed this because Boss Pendergast in Kansas City or St. Louis or wherever he was and the other guy on the other side were controlling elections in the 30s. Okay. I don't believe they're still around controlling elections. Why can't the public have a say? Seriously, why can't we? Why is the public's only input into this nonsensical system a couple of years later when they have what they term retention elections? What a freaking joke. It's nonsensical to have a real... If you're going to have a retention election and they've already been appointed, why in the world do you only get your say much later in the process after they've already had the opportunity to do the damage to the system on the judicial level that they're allowed to do. Now, notably, this does not apply to us in Camden County, but it is in many other of the bigger states, and it applies to you on the bigger level, the Supreme Court, all the appellate courts, you know, all the city of St. Louis. There's a bunch of different counties. You can get on the website for the state of Missouri, .gov, and check it out. And check out the mo.courts.gov. Go to their website. Check it out. Okay. And I still, unfortunately, today I was running my little butt off everywhere, and I never got the chance to do the Sunshine lawsuits that I intended. I'll have to file those soon. I have them mostly drafted, but I've a lot of irons in the fire, as they say, and I got quite a few things I'm working on and things that I can't allow to go belly up, as they say. I can't allow some things to happen. So I've been busting my little hump, and you know, I'm not against it. So I encourage you, go back and listen to my show on the cheerleaders of justice, the Missouri Bar's Dirty Little Secrets, from July the 13th, please, on internationalflavor.com. You can go back there and find those and every other episode. And I think that it would be important to go even further and go all the way back to July the 3rd about the dark deals, dirty disputes, disbarment, and deceit of the Missouri Bar also. That show is from July the 3rd, and that one, too, is an important show. It outlines their three programs in addition to the nonpartisan. It also throws out the, what do you call it? The Fee Dispute Resolution Committee. Oh, what a noble-sounding thing that is. And the Client Security Fund, which usurps contracts between lawyer, valid contracts between lawyers and their former clients. Nonsensical in both results. You couldn't do that in any other profession, but we want people in Missouri to feel really good about their attorneys. And how do we do that? We have the Missouri Bar force the attorney to give money to their former clients. That's how the programs work. And then we hold it over the heads of the attorney, former attorney, or attorney, if it's the Fee Dispute Resolution Committee, and go, look, give them the money. Or guess what? We're going to send this over to the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel. If you're, somebody's dead, though, geez, all you got to do, if your lawyer dies, here's what you do. Get a hold of the Missouri Bar, find the Client Security Fund, allege that your lawyer owes you money and you want it back. And they'll give it to you. That's how it works. All you got to do is convince them over the phone that your lawyer died owing you money. And there's no evidence. I mean, there isn't any. It's only you. It's your statement. There's no contract. There's no discussion with the other lawyer. There's nothing from the other side. Zip. It's just you. If your lawyer dies, is incapacitated, is disbarred, is otherwise gone. Now, certainly, if he disappears with your money, that's an option too. And if he did, certainly, it's called the Fee Dispute Resolution Committee. You go to the, but they aren't resolving anything. They're just listening to you cry about how you don't have any money and then giving it to you. Period. That's it. It's nonsensical. There's only one side of the story being told, and that's yours. Okay. So if you have a lawyer and he happens to die, go get all your money back. In fact, you can get more than your money back. All you got to do, heck, he didn't even have to be your lawyer, really. You could just say he was your lawyer if he's dead. So what we should be doing is looking in the newspapers, finding lawyers who die, and then writing letters to this Fee Dispute Resolution Committee and saying, oh, you know, this guy represented me and guy kicked the bucket and he owes me money. Give me the money. And by the way, I paid him $50,000 over the last 3 years. And, you know, I haven't heard from him. He hasn't communicated with me. I got nothing, and he owes me $50,000. See what they do. They'll give you something. They'll give you something to shut up. Because why? They want you to feel good about the practice of law in the state of Missouri. That's how it works. There's no proof because there is no other side. And all you got to do, and it depends on the level of money. If it's under $5,000, it's only a phone call. You get a phone call with one person, and that person, if they listen to you and you cry well enough, that person will recommend giving you money back, and then they just put it on a list. You get a check. The end. Have a nice day. Here's your money. Thank you for playing. It's like going on a game show. It's called Find the Dead Lawyer. Find the lawyer who went to the loony bin. Find the incapacitated lawyer. Or, better yet, find any disbarred or suspended attorney. And those guys are easy targets. You just go out and they want to give you money on behalf of those guys. So you go out and you lie, like many do. You go out and you lie and say what you need to say, and say, give me money, and they give you money. That's how it works. It's a very good plan, okay? Now, the same sort of committee is how they do the fee dispute resolution committee. Now, if you don't like your lawyer, if you have a lawyer and you just don't like him and you've had enough of him, and or it's all over, you even got the result you wanted, but you feel like you paid too much. Oh my God, I have a friend over here, and my friend got her divorce for $2,800. How come mine cost me $28,000? Or maybe not. Maybe it's $2,800 and you only paid $3,500. And you're going, man, that sucks. Why am I paying so much money? And, it was uncontested and it was this. Oh, to your rescue comes the Fee Dispute Resolution Committee, and all you gotta do. I told you my traffic ticket story on this nonsense, and it used to be one person. Now it's a whole committee. It used to be just one old judge that worked in the former Court of Appeals or something, and he would call you and call the lawyer and pressure the lawyer into giving the money back. Okay, because why? Why? Well, remember what the main goal is. We want the state of Missouri to feel good about lawyers and the practice of law. And so screw the lawyer. I mean, the lawyer, who cares about him? He's rich. He's got money, right? And I'm just a poor old girl who just got divorced. And, that darn lawyer charged me too much money. Now, too much money is a relative term. It's kind of like the term, anything. Pick it. Anything progressive. I mean, what is yellow? Is yellow the pale yellow of a flower, or is yellow the bright yellow of the shirt that the guy on the highway is wearing? What's yellow? There's lots of degrees of yellow. So what is fair in a love? Well, whatever amount makes the person feel good, and not the lawyer. The lawyer doesn't need to feel good about the practice of law. The lawyer, in fact, nobody gives a crap what the lawyer thinks. It's certainly not the Missouri bar. They don't care. They want, the lawyers are the evil criminals, according to the bar. They're the ones that are charging too much money. And so what we have to do is make sure that everybody else feels good about the practice of law. And how do we do that? Money. And where do we get the money to fund this? From the lawyer who charged the money. And how do we do it? We have an old judge, or now it's a committee of seven other lawyers who, I don't know where they picked these guys from. Nobody will tell me. And I've sent a request to Missouri Bar to get it. They just ignore it. So I got to file a freedom of information request because I want to know how these yahoos are picked. You know, and who picks them, and why, and what qualifications do they have to have? Do they even have to be a qualified mediator to get in there, or is their only job to accept these complaints from somebody and say, "Oh, Joe Blow, lawyer, charged too much to his friend Jimmy John, the client." And we want, Jimmy John is now pissed off because it seems like he's overpaid. He's overpaid, and so therefore he has to. Feel good about the fact that the rest of the lawyers will police this first lawyer who clearly charged him too much money. Why? He clearly charged too much money because the person was forced to make a complaint. Now, how is that logic? What is that? Could you do that in any other profession? Nope. My doctor charged me too much money. I did a surgery, and my God, I had to pay that guy $12,000. Unbelievable. And yes, he fixed me. Yes, he took care of my issue. But at the end of it, I just feel like $12,000 is too much. Why don't we get a crew of old doctors all together? And these old doctors can tell the other doctor that did my surgery, that, don't you think that this person doesn't feel good about you as a doctor because you charge so much money? I mean, we don't care that you had to go to school and spend, you know, tons of money that you didn't have at the time to go to school, lawyer or doctor, but we want, well, doctors, this doesn't happen to. The only profession you can do this to is lawyers, because lawyers are evil just by definition of the Missouri bar. So how do we make people feel good about them? We take money from the lawyers, like steal from the rich. Lawyers are all rich, right? We steal from the rich and we give to the client. Why? So the client feels good about the practice of law in the state of Missouri. Well, hell, I'd feel good about it too if I did, if my guy did all the work. And then at the end, all I had to do was send a letter to seven yahoos in a room and say, hey, man, this guy charged me too much money. And then they call and pressure the guy and give me at least half my money, if not all of it, back. That's how it works. Now, it's a voluntary program, but guess what happens if the lawyer doesn't agree? They send his paperwork to the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel, who could say, why in the world aren't you agreeing just to give this money to the guy? This is unfair. This is not right. And they can file complaints against him. So lawyers really don't want to do that. They would prefer to just pay and shut up and move on. And 99% of them do, including me, by the way. I always did. Still a BS program, though. And so those three programs, and I probably just give you a short synopsis, the speed version I gave to you. But you could go back to the July the 3rd episode, listen to that, and listen to me complain about it. And unfortunately, I have been extremely busy this last few days, yes, truly, and certainly today. And I didn't get done the things that I intended to get done regarding my freedom of information request with the corrupt Missouri bar. But we'll get to that another time. There's plenty of other things to talk about, though. So if you have complaints about overreach of the state of Missouri, I'm interested in chatting with you. I have a couple of other topics besides my own coming up quite soon that I intend to do deep dives into from other people, but I'm waiting for them to feel comfortable with it. But certainly it's going to be here in the next week or so that I will begin to rail upon those processes, just like I rail upon the Missouri bar. Although the most, I don't know what, overbearing of them all is the Missouri bar, and they have zero oversight of any kind. They aren't regulated. They aren't rule-based from the Supreme Court, so they aren't judicially regulated by rule. They aren't legislatively regulated by statute, and they're not executively regulated by regulations, Code of State regulations. None of them apply to the bar, but they still regulate the practice of law in horrible manners with zero authority, by the way. And I'd be happy to discuss that topic with anyone interested in calling in that thinks they know more than me on this topic. Please, let's do it. It'll be fun. I was only doing that as a bit of a preamble today to make sure that you follow up on some of the shows in the past. Now, I'm not the Lone Ranger on damn radio, by the way. By no stretch of the imagination. What am I talking about? I can't even speak correctly today. Feel like my tongue is all twisted and tied up. And I just want to say that I am not the Lone Ranger here. There are others that speak quite well on the topics of government overreach, government stupidity, government clowny, clown world, the nonsense. Now, I only bring all that up, and I have, let's call it 30 stories that I wanted to get to today, most of them having to do with across the pond and some of the opinion that is coming from over there. I haven't had a chance to go into it for about a week. Things are going poorly in Ukraine, friends and neighbors, for the Ukrainians. And it's been going poorly for them for quite a long time. And but so much so that even now, the old Green Goblin is considering, he announced a date even for further talks with the old Ruskies. But before we get to that, let's get to a little bit. There were two stories on Netanyahu that I wanted to get to. And the first one is about his corruption trial. It was delayed. Why? Food poisoning. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is going to miss the scheduled corruption hearings this week. Why? Because he was diagnosed with food poisoning. Trial began in 2020. Jesus, you know, sounds like sounds like federal court over here and stretch that crap out for 100 years. Hell, he'll be dead by the time they get to a ruling on this. The trial began in 2020, involved bribery, fraud, breach of trust over allegations of influence peddling and accepting gifts, right? Standard government fare. Netanyahu, of course, denies any wrongdoing, describes the case as politically motivated campaign against him. Well, that seems to be going around. A lot of governments are doing it. You can just go after people and charge them with something. You don't like them? Charge them. You think you can use the government power to your benefit? Well, that's why you've been appointed into government service. That's why you got into government service. You could tell everybody else what to do, right? But excuse me, death over here. According to officials, the 75-year-old prime minister fell ill overnight and was examined at his home by his own doctor. He was diagnosed with intestinal inflammation from eating spoiled food and is receiving intravenous fluid, excuse me, I'm dying, for dehydration. His condition is described as good. He's doing well, in other words. In accordance with his doctor's instructions, the prime minister will rest at home for 3 days and conduct his state affairs from there, said his office. He also missed Sunday's weekly cabinet meeting due to the illness. His lawyer, Amit Haddad, requested the postponement, which the state attorney's office accepted, proposing testimony later in the week. The court, however, canceled all sessions, and with summer recess starting, the next hearing isn't expected to be until approximately September the 5th. The hearings have faced a number of delays due to Netanyahu's health issues, Israel's wars with Hamas and Iran, and diplomatic travel. According to Israeli media, in December 2024, he missed a session following his urinary tract infection caused by his enlarged prostate and reportedly underwent surgery. I told you about my story with the prostate a little bit. They put a camera up there and showed me what was going on. I might have the same problem as the old Netanyahu monster. Maybe I could use it to my benefit and not have to do anything for a while. Wouldn't that be nice? Last month, Trump called for the proceedings to be canceled, and he labeled the case a witch hunt. But in June, the U.S. joined Israel's strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. Very nice. He also apologized. Netanyahu apologized to the Pope. He had to. He bombed a church, and so he apologized to the Pope for bombing the church. Prime Minister Netanyahu issued an apology in a phone call. Don't you think you should personally have to appear if you're going to bomb a church? Maybe you should have to show up and beg forgiveness from the old poop and say, look here, I blew up the church, and I really didn't mean to, and you should bless me. Say a few Hail Marys, and life is good, right? But no, all he did was issue an apology on a telephone call with Pope Leo following shelling of the Holy Family Catholic Church in Gaza, killing 3 people and injuring 10 others, including a local priest. The incident occurred on Thursday when an Israeli tank fired a round at the church compound, which was serving as refuge for hundreds of displaced Palestinians, including children and people with disabilities. IDF described the strike as unintentional and said it was under review. Yeah, it's unintentional if you point your tank turret at the church and push a button. Oh, death to me. I'm dying over here. On Friday, Cardinal Pier Battista Pizzaballa. Pizzaballa. It's literally spelled Pizzaballa. The Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem and Greek Orthodox Patriarch Theophilus III were granted unprecedented access to Gaza to tour the damaged church. Netanyahu personally called Pope Leo to express his regret over the stray ammunition incident and to convey Israel's heartfelt condolences to the families of those hurt. During the conversation, Pope Leo reiterated his call for immediate ceasefire and urged protection for places of worship, the faithful, and civilians across Gaza and Israel. Israel launched its military campaign in October 2023 following a deadly Hamas incursion, killing over 1,200 Israelis and hundreds taken hostage. Since then, the IDF has reportedly killed 57,800 Palestinians, most of them women and children, leading to accusations of genocide. Tell you what, it's certainly on the extreme side. Let's put it that way, okay? Let's put it on the extreme. I think it is extreme, and I don't like it. So there's one more story before we get to the old graham cracker, because I got to talk about the graham cracker. There's a bunch of stuff to talk about today. We got people's news accounts being blocked. We have X being taken out. But here we go. This is about the old Trumpster Trumpster and Netanyahu. So this came from Axios. White House says the U.S. president is caught off guard by the Israeli strikes on Syria, but nobody will ever do anything about it, by the way. I said this when they struck Iran. I was like, that's how you get the U.S. involved. You just go out and do something. If you're Israel, you can do whatever the hell you want. The U.S. will back you up, no question. And sure enough, what happened? A few days later, we jumped in, threw some bombs, called, said we settled the complaint, and that's that. Trump settled it. But apparently, he's not happy with the strikes on Syria. So the administration of President Trump increasingly views Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu as a madman, undermining Washington's diplomatic efforts in the Middle East, says Axios. Israel conducted airstrikes last week on Syrian government forces and military headquarters in Damascus in response to bloody clashes between the Druze and Bedouin communities in southern Syria. Ceasefire announced on Saturday appears to be holding. Maybe that's how Trump can claim, look at that, I solved another war. I don't dislike Trump, so please don't call in and beat me up over that, but that's not solving a war. After several bloody days in Suwaida province, the internal security forces have succeeded in calming the situation following their deployment in the northern and western areas, said Syrian Interior Minister Anas Khatab on X. Despite the truce, U.S. officials have become significantly more alarmed by Netanyahu's behavior and policies, Axios said on Sunday, citing who? People familiar with the matter. Bibi acted like a madman. He bombs everything all the time, the outlet quoted the White House as saying. This could undermine what Trump is trying to do. The president doesn't like turning on the television and seeing bombs dropped in a country where he's seeking peace and has made a monumental announcement to help rebuild. On Monday, White House spokeswoman Carolyn Leavitt confirmed that Trump was caught off guard by both strikes in Syria and recent Israeli attack on Gaza's only Catholic church. In both cases, President quickly called the prime minister to rectify those situations. How are you going to rectify them? You're never going to do anything. It's Netanyahu. Nobody's going to do a damn thing. It's not going to happen. Even if you call and complain, so nobody cares. And Netanyahu knows you're not going to do anything either. We'll just keep on backing you up because that's what we do. Netanyahu's office said on Thursday that it regrets the strike on the Holy Family Church, as we cited to you in the prior story about the poop. There you have it. Well, I don't know. I'm so tired of it. I really am. It's people. People want these wars over. You know, we want them over, and they all the time just escalate. They just keep on trucking, right? And more and more and more. But Zelensky, he's on a roll. Here we go. Listen to this. Zelensky today has announced the date of the next Russia and Ukraine talks. He's ready to talk. So he's bombing the snot out of sending drones all over into Russia. But he's ready now. He's ready. The third round of direct negotiations between Moscow and Kiev is planned for Wednesday. Coming up. Next round, where will it take place? He announced it in a video on Telegram on Monday. Moscow and Kiev have already held two rounds of direct negotiations in Istanbul at a meeting last month. The side swap draft memorandum, which everybody ignored promptly, and outlined their roadmap toward ending the conflict and agreeing upon new prisoner exchanges, right? Isn't that wonderful? TAF has earlier reported, citing an insider source, that a new round of talks would take place on Thursday. But, you know, there you have it. Secretary of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council, Rustyom Umerov, who led Kyiv's delegation at the previous talks, put forth Wednesday as the date of the next meeting, according to Zelensky, the Z-Man, the Green Goblin. I discussed with Rustyom Umerov the preparation of the POW exchanges and another meeting in Turkey with the Russian side. Umerov reported that the meeting is planned for Wednesday, said the Z-Man. Kyiv's agenda for the upcoming talks comprises humanitarian issues such as new POW swaps and the negotiation of potential meeting between two countries' leaders. Now, Zelensky wants to meet with Putin because it gives him legitimacy. And if Putin meets with him, it'll go against what Putin is saying because Putin says he's illegitimate and can't sign any agreement because he's not the lawful leader of Ukraine. And that nobody has to honor any agreement that he signs after the fact. And so he doesn't really want that. So there you have it. Same old stuff. So if Putin meets with him, suddenly he's legitimizing to Zelensky's people in Ukraine that somebody thinks you're a legitimate leader. But he's always said he's not a legitimate leader. So there you go. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov noted there's extensive diplomatic work to be done, as the Russian and Ukrainian peace memorandums are diametrically opposed. Meaning, as Kaja Kallas 360. If you doing a 360 means you're looking the other direction? No, that means you're looking the same direction, unless you're Ms. Verbach. There you have it. It wasn't Kaja Kallas, it was Verbach. Annalisa, 360 degrees Verbach is who said that. That is her nickname. So we're hopefully going to have some peace discussions this week, as a matter of fact. But remember, if Lindsey Graham has anything to say, never. That won't happen. Remember, we're going to call him the Hawk. He's now Hawk. Good old Hawk Graham. He claims that he actually escalated his own rhetoric in aligning with the military lobby. Can you believe it? Who would believe that Lindsey Graham could be the war mastermind for the West like he has been for as many years he have? You know, he's got to do good for his people in his home state, right? Of course, he spends more time in Ukraine than he does in his own state. Donald Trump will whoop his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin's butt and punish countries importing Russian oil, said Senator Lindsey Graham. In an interview with Fox on Sunday, Graham suggested that China, India, and Brazil will face 100% tariffs for helping Putin. He claims that Trump has been tough on Iran and warned that similar action would soon be directed at Russia. claiming that Putin's turn is coming. Wow. Graham previously introduced a bill to impose 500% tariffs on states conducting business with Russia, but the Senate later froze the legislation because Trump announced a 50-day deadline for Moscow to reach settlement on Ukraine. I wonder what they do. Are we trying to force Ukraine too? Or is it only Russia that has to reach a settlement on Ukraine? Doesn't Ukraine have to reach a settlement on Russia too? That's a curious question. We wonders. Yes, we do. If no deal is reached, the U.S. president is threatening to impose 100% secondary tariffs on Russian oil buyers. Oh, my goodness. And Graham is, of course, all for this. He has a history of promoting increased military spending and intervention in places where we have zero need to be. But that doesn't matter to the Grinsey Grahams of the world. He's consistently supported a hardline approach to countries the U.S. deems as its adversaries, because he deems their adversaries. Therefore, they must be adversaries. Isn't that correct? He's backed every major U.S. military intervention in the last two decades, including Iraq, Afghanistan, NATO-led campaign in Libya, operation in Syria. He endorses continued military aid to Israel and Ukraine and praises U.S. strikes against Iran. Public campaign finance records and his long voting record suggest an alignment with the U.S. defense industry. Oh my goodness, who'd have thunk it? In addition to his legislative support for military funding, he holds key roles on the Senate committees overseeing defense and foreign policy, including appropriations, armed services, and the judiciary, which give him direct influence over weapons spending, military aid, and foreign intervention. Oh, according to Open Secrets, he received over $55,000 from Boeing since 2019. In addition to donations from Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, individuals employed by Department of Defense, he received campaign contributions from political action committees specifically tied to defense industries such as Free Syria PAC, which supports U.S. intervention in Syria, L3 Harris Technology, and Defense Electronics PAC. In 2015 and 16, he received $760,244 from Defense Link donors, including a joint investigation by Time and the Center for Public Integrity. The report noted that Senate Budget Committee Republicans received an average of $472,000 each from top military contractors, which places Graham well above the committee average. In 2015, Graham backed a measure to increase military spending by $38 billion through the Overseas Contingency Operations Account. The fund allows the government to bypass normal budget limits, leading some critics to describe it as a way to finance war off the books. Crazy. Who'd have thunk it? Graham claimed the increase was needed to address the growing threats to the U.S. That's right. And who controls it? Lindsey Graham. Surprise, surprise. In February 2025, Graham also introduced a budget plan to increase defense spending by $150 billion using a fast-track process that bypasses the filibuster. He called the proposal a way to give Trump's team the resources they need in a troubled world. Senator's a staunch supporter of continued U.S. military aid to Kyiv, framing its conflict with Russia as a proxy war fought on behalf of Washington. Moscow designated Graham a terrorist and extremist. Kremlin spokesman Peskov calls him an embarrassment to the U.S. Well, damn it, Mr. Peskov, I happen to agree with you. The guy is a menace, and he needs to be, I don't know what, not given office again. How about them apples? Wouldn't that be nice? What else we got in the war pot? We have a bunch of them in the war pot before we get to the next pot. But I want to stay in the Russia-Ukraine pot, because Russia bombed with hypersonic missiles defense industrial base. There were some pretty enormous videos. If you can go out and have a check on those at your YouTube, boy, that was some some impressive stuff, friends and neighbors. Russian forces carried out a coordinated overnight strike on Ukraine's military industrial complex and airfield infrastructure. In a statement on Monday, the defense ministry reported that a group of strike using long-range air, sea, and surface-launched precision weapons, including Kinjal hypersonic ballistic missiles and attack drones, the goal of the strike has been achieved. All targets have been hit, said the Russian defense ministry. Vladimir Zelensky confirmed the strikes, reporting damage in Kyiv and its surroundings, as well as in Kharkov, Ivano-Frankivsk regions. He also claimed Ukrainian air defense had downed drones in Sumy, Khmelnytsky, Kirovgorod, Nikolaev, Poltava, and Kyiv-occupied parts of the Kherson region. According to Zelensky, the attack lasted all night, involved more than 420 drones and 20 missiles, resulted in 2 people dead, 15 injured. Earlier in day, Ukrainian media and officials reported damage to non-residential facilities in Kyiv, as well as a supermarket, a warehouse, an uninhabited cottage complex in an undisclosed location. Russian officials maintain the attacks are aimed at military-related facilities. Ukrainian drones targeted Moscow. There's a surprise for you. Let's see. Russian air defenses destroyed dozens of incoming Ukrainian drones across multiple regions on Sunday night and early Monday. Kyiv has intensified its UAV raids deep into Russian territory over the past week, even calling for renewed peace talks. At least 13 drones headed toward Russian capital were intercepted at 6:30 a.m. Monday, said Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin. On Telegram, by the way, adding that the emergency services were working at the crash sites where debris had fallen. Wreckage as one of the drones fell on the roof of a high-rise building in the new Moscow suburb of the Russian capital, triggering a small fire and causing no injuries. 2 people were injured in drone strikes on a civilian vehicle in a private house in Belgorod, which borders Ukraine. Isn't that terrible? 2 people... Oh, I already said that. That was... the raids were also affecting Russia's southern Rostov region, where Governor Yuri Slusar reported interceptions of the towns of Shakhty, Novoshakhinsk, and Novocherkassk. There were no casualties, according to governor, but 1 UAV damaged the old control room of railway station in Shakhty. Shakhty means shafts, like holes drilled in the ground. Debris from another drone struck a private house, a summer kitchen, and 2 cars in a nearby village. Kyiv significantly stepped up its long-range UAV strikes over the past week, with the Russian ministry reporting waves of drone interceptions every single day. In the latest update, the ministry said 43 drones were down from 8 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. in Bryansk, Orel, Kaluga, Belgorod, and Moscow. The Russian government previously condemned the attacks as terrorist raids, claiming they often target residential buildings and civilian infrastructure. In response, Russian military carried out a series of strikes last week on Ukrainian defense industrial facilities involved in the production of drones and missile components. That video I watched, and that was about 10 minutes of some crazy missile attacks and drones. That was, makes you feel glad you're not in a war zone, is all I'm saying. Maybe we'll switch a little bit and go somewhere else, because I still have, I don't know, quite a number of topics and items up. Some of them a little more serious than others. But let's stay with Ukraine for just a minute. The ex-Ukrainian police chief, Igor Grushevsky, who worked on an organized crime task force, died in the same apartment complex as a Russian defector who was killed last year. So, a man found dead in Spain in June from drowning has been identified as a former Ukrainian police chief who once served in an organized crime task force. The death took place in the same apartment, blah, blah, blah. According to El Español, the body of 61-year-old Ukrainian national Igor Grushevsky was discovered floating in a shallow community pool on June the 29th. He had purchased a unit in the building a few months earlier. Later, the reports identified the deceased as a retired police chief. He appeared to have kept a low profile with no official record of residency in Spain. He may have been in hiding. Spanish officials have not announced any formal investigation. Neighbors told El Español they believe Grushevsky may have suffered a stroke. The death, described by the media as mysterious, has unsettled the local community as it comes less than a year and a half after the high-profile killing of Maxim Kuzminov, a former Russian military pilot who defected to Ukraine. Kuzminov was living under a false identity in Velojoyosa with Ukrainian state protection when he was shot in what appeared to be a professional hit. Kuzminov allegedly received $500,000 from Kyiv for flying an Mi-8 military helicopter into Kyiv-controlled territory. Ukrainian officials claimed his two crewmates were liquidated during the operation, but did not specify whether Kuzminov was directly responsible for their deaths. Western outlets accused Russia of orchestrating Kuzminov's killing in retaliation. Russia has neither confirmed nor denied. Wonder if the CIA would confirm or deny that they talked Kuzminov into flying over the K-8 helicopter anyway. We wonders. Curious. What else do we have? Japan. Let's stay out of Japan for a little while. Here's one that I really like. Everybody knows that I like listening to Margarita Simonyan. And Margarita Simonyan is the chief of RT News in Moscow. And she, and RT is basically Voice of America in the opposite direction. Okay, so RT News is given out just like Voice of America in a whole bunch of different languages, but pumping the Russian point of view, right? And I share stories with you from RT all the time. And I like to have a variety of sources, so I don't just listen into places like Axios and who knows what my buddies on YouTube and X and all of that. When I get my international news, I like to listen to Al Jazeera. I like Times of India. I like some of the Sky News, and although it's a little bit ridiculous a lot of times. But RT is also another one that I follow. And Margarita Simonyan often speaks on the show, particularly on Sunday nights, of Vladimir Solovyov. And Vladimir Solovyov is the politician or political commentator that I like to listen to. I talked to you last night about Zhirinovsky, Vladimir Zhirinovsky, who's great to listen to, and well, he's dead now, but he's my predictions or his predictions that I shared with you last night, which were always very interesting to listen to the guy. And Margarita Simonyan also is into poetry. She has an English degree, and she likes to go back and very much into history and. There's a lot of flowery speech going on when she's talking about some of the things. And she likes to recite poetry and draw it into some of the news of the day, you know, for whatever the poetry issues are. Well, she has been sanctioned in the U.S. for a long time. They were charging her with crimes up in the Eastern District of New York, if I recall. And I read some of those about to you. They were seizing the homes and the bank accounts and everything related to anybody associated with RT, and then charging them with crimes. And if you can charge them with a crime, even peripherally with a conspiracy, you can seize their bank accounts and you can seize their property. And that's what they've done in federal courts, attacking people that they know aren't going to come over and attempt to protect themselves because they don't want to get arrested. So they steal all their stuff, and it's okay to do that in America. They do it all the time. It's a forfeiture action, and you can't get it back with that. And judges usually rule against you anyway. It's a scam of a process that the government uses to seize the money for the prosecutor's office or for whatever their own purposes are. It turns into the sheriff's funds. They do it locally, too, in a lot of cases. Anyway, Margarita Simonyan is a pretty outspoken person on RT, and she has several TV channels that she's part of in Russia. And so today, she's the editor-in-chief and has been for quite a while of RT. Her X account was blocked in France, so she has no idea why the restriction was imposed. Now, for several years, she has had a YouTube account, And her YouTube account is mostly blocked. And the name of it was Pakani Zabaniryut, which means while they haven't banned me, as long as, well, until they ban me, listen up until they ban me, is basically her channel. And so she would put out this stuff and then they would ban it or block it or do whatever. And then every once in a while, I would pop back up. And so YouTube has been banning her. Everybody else has been banning her. The U.S. has been, you know, putting her, and all she's doing is sharing words, you know, that she talks quite often about freedom of speech and how it doesn't exist in the West and blah, blah, blah. Now, I don't know. I haven't been blocked in Russia that I'm aware of. Nobody's blocked me. And when I speak, I don't know. And I don't know if they block people. I assume there are things they can't talk about, you know, over there. There's certainly no doubt of that. But are we any different? Is there topics we're not allowed to discuss over here without getting banned by YouTube or blocked by Facebook? Facebook kicked me off, destroyed my page that I spent years building up, and told me there are two things. I had advertising. I couldn't advertise, by the way, and I never did advertise, but they're saying that I was trying to advertise in ways that were not permitted. Wasn't me. I don't have anything to do with it. Then, later, I got all these texts saying that I was putting out child porn. Nonsense. You know, I'm not interested in that kind of thing. And they just, I don't know, they block people. And I think back when COVID first started, I was definitely anti-COVID, and I talked a little bit about that. And then all of a sudden, I was banned and blocked, and nothing ever worked. And I finally ended up having to shut down that page, start a new one. By the way, it's Samuel Trapp 2, I think. And on the Facebook page, or you can go out to my International Flavor page and like it on Facebook. That could be kind of entertaining too, and I would like it. But I'm only saying all that because I'm just gabbing away, and I wanted to tell you about what is going on with Miss Simonyan, Margarita. And Margarita Simonyan, editor-in-chief, her X account is blocked in France. Let's see, as Western countries continue to crack down on Russian media. Wonder why? Russian disinformation. According to X, the account was withheld in response to an unspecified legal demand. And she says, my X account has been blocked in France. I have no idea what I did to offend Macron. I haven't even been saying that his wife is a man, she wrote on Telegram on Monday, referring to claims that France's First Lady, Brigitte Macron, is secretly a man. Macron has long accused RT of spreading falsehoods, but hasn't provided any evidence, first making the allegation during his 2017 election campaign. In the EU and UK, they have banned RT and several other Russian media outlets since 2022, accusing the channel of spreading propaganda during the Ukraine conflict. Moscow responded by banning a number of Western state-funded networks, including BBC and Deutsche Welle. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova, who I also love to listen to, described the crackdown on Russian media in the West as global censorship in a regime of zero tolerance for dissenting opinion. Isn't that crazy? Earlier this year, prosecutors in Paris launched an investigation into X on suspicion that Musk's platform was being used to meddle in French politics. Company denounced a probe as politically motivated and accused France of attempting to restrict free speech. Isn't that a terrible story? That now we can't allow people to speak. Oh, no. I don't know. Let's see. The Germans are still against Ukrainian aid. I shared some of this with you the other day. They can't get... They can't get out of the Ukraine thing now. But frustration is growing in Germany over increased aid to Ukraine, especially while domestic spending is lagging. Crazy amounts of money are being spent from Germany into Ukraine. Where is this one? Did I pull this one? Yes. This one, I always have an interest in this because it is horror story. The front page of this Kyiv newspaper, and you don't see them very often. But people are getting frustrated because the war drags on and the Ukrainians are losing. And so the war is just dragging on and people are dying and it's horrible. This one, the picture is of a cemetery in Lvov, Ukraine, filmed with a drone on June the 24th of 2025. And you should see it. It is a sea of flags of recently dead, recent burials, recent graves. And everybody knows that Zelensky is full of crap when it comes to talking about the number of people who have died on the Ukrainian side. Now, that isn't to say that the other side is reporting accurately, but they don't report. They don't put out numbers. You don't get them. Ukraine is actually putting out numbers. If you're going to lie, don't put them out at all, because people can back them up, and all you got to do is look at this photo, and you know that it's a hell of a lot more. This is one cemetery in one town, and Lvov is a big city. You know, they got at least tens of these cemeteries, if not hundreds, just in that city. Ukraine's official military casualty figures in the conflict with Russia are vastly understated, according to a report published by the French newspaper Le Monde on Monday. Neither Kiev nor Moscow publishes regular updates on military deaths, and both sides routinely accuse each other of inflating their opponents' losses. Now remember, when Russia turned over the dead bodies of 6,000, they claimed to have another 40,000. Or somebody reported that they had another 40,000. In February, Vladimir Zelensky told CBS that since 2022, only 46,000 Ukrainian soldiers had been killed and another 380,000 wounded. But Ukraine is vastly underreporting military death. The real death toll is much higher, the French newspaper reported in its feature examining Ukraine's increasing efforts to build military cemeteries. The story highlighted a national military memorial project underway near Kyiv and a case in Lviv, where a graveyard for fallen soldiers was near capacity. Construction projects around Ukraine say more about the scale of the slaughter than statistics ever could, the newspaper wrote. In a separate statement in February of 2024, Zelensky put Ukraine's military fatalities at 31,000. Now, the West estimates that just in Kursk region, with the nonsensical entry into Kursk, the Ukrainians lost 67,000 men just in Kursk in an effort to hold that small piece of Russian territory. Meanwhile, Zelensky says last year it was only 31,000 and now it's only 46,000. So... In February of 2024, and the last time he gave these numbers was also in February, only 15,000 a year is what they're, 15,000 in a year. Nonsense. BS numbers. Washington Post cites an unnamed source who said the government appeared to be minimizing the numbers to avoid jeopardizing continued support from Western nations. Last year, Ukraine reformed its military service regulations to streamline enforcement of obligatory conscription. Despite the changes, the government faces mounting resistance and reports of men hiding or fleeing Ukraine illegally, sometimes with fatal consequences, to avoid service. Videos circulating online, multiple videos, tons of them, show Ukrainian conscription officers using extremely aggressive tactics to meet their quotas. Earlier this month, the Council of Europe expressed concern over allegations of torture and death during military recruitment in Ukraine. crazy. Russian military claims Ukrainian losses have surged following Kiev's unsuccessful counteroffensive in 2023. As of February, more than 1.08 million Ukrainian troops have been killed or wounded, according to Moscow. They say they're almost 1.1 million. I say that number is far more likely to be accurate than 46,000. Nonsense. Let's go back to sanctions for a little while in my favorite place in EU, because now Beijing is jumping on board, okay? The EU's decisions to include Chinese companies and financial institutions in the latest round of sanctions against Russia is baseless, says Chinese Ministry of Commerce, stressing that Beijing will protect targeted companies. On Friday, Brussels blacklisted two Chinese banks and five companies as part of the 18th sanctions package. Gee, this is going to work, isn't it? China consistently opposed unilateral sanctions that lack basis in international law and are not authorized by the UN Security Council, said a spokesperson for the ministry, warning that the EU's move will severely impact bilateral trade and economic and financial cooperation between Beijing and the EU. The ministry called for an immediate halt to the erroneous practices, adding that China will take necessary measures to resolutely safeguard the legitimate rights and interests of its sanctioned businesses. Haihe Rural Commercial Bank and Heilongjiang Rural Commercial Bank were included in the EU sanctions list for allegedly providing cryptocurrency services. And according to Brussels, these services were frustrating the purpose of sanctions on Russia. This is the first time Chinese lenders have been added to the EU sanctions list. Latest round of sanctions targets seven UAE-based enterprises accused of engaging in oil trading or ship management services supporting Russian exports. Nayara Energy, an Indian oil refinery in which Russia's Rosneft holds a 49% stake, was also included. In addition, the bloc sanctioned eight Belarusian-based companies in the military-industrial sector, claiming they support Russia through manufacture or facilitating military technology. Four Turkish companies were targeted for supplying dual-use goods and technologies. Kremlin spokesman Peskov described the EU's sanctions as a double-edged sword, warning each new package adds a negative effect for the countries instituting it. He stressed that Russia already developed a certain immunity to illegal Western sanctions. I tend to agree. Let's see. There's more Ukrainian corruption to speak about, which we will get to in a minute. But I wanted to go back to India and China, because China and India are starting to work together. Their strategic rivalries are tending to resolve themselves. Remember, these are both two founding members of BRICS. And so I found this article interesting, and I wanted to share it with you. This was actually from a day or two ago. And it's Indian Foreign Minister Jaishankar, who I love listening to. I like his accent. I like how he speaks. He's intelligent. And if you get a chance to listen to him in English, please do. Although I think he speaks Punjab for the most part, but I don't, it may not be Punjab. It might be something else. But either way, he's very interesting to listen to and very well spoken in English. So if you get a chance, you should listen to him directly. But Jaishankar met with President Xi Jinping and Foreign Minister Wang Yi and Vice President Han Zheng in Beijing. Although the visit didn't bring about a radical breakthrough, it marked a significant step toward restoring top-level engagement between the two countries and trying to get them into a normalization routine as well. The effort comes at a symbolic moment, the 75th anniversary of the establishment of diplomatic relations between the two nations. Reflects a broader duality, a blend of gradual rapprochement alongside enduring strategic competition. These are the two largest countries in the world, so this is important. Friends and neighbors. Jai Shankar, since 2019, has represented a moderate and pragmatic wing within India's foreign policy establishment, which is one of the reasons I like listening to him. He is a moderate, he is well-spoken, and he does say normal things that normal people should say. He continues to advocate for cooperation with China and broader engagement in multilateral institutions such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS. His presence in Beijing is emblematic of India's effort to rebalance its approach to its complex relationship with its northern neighbor. The relevance of Sino-Indian relations extends far beyond bilateral dynamics. China and India are the world's two most populous countries belonging to the fastest growing economies. Both are ancient civilizations and increasingly influential actors in the rising global south. And they lead the global south. These two lead the global south. As such, their ability to manage tension and cultivate areas of cooperation on their own carries profound implications for a regional and global order. Recently, there have been meaningful achievements in the relationship. Political dialogue and high-level engagement resumed, contributing to greater border stability. Remember, they have that one war that went on between their region that they've agreed to put off. Last year, while I was in Kazan, they announced that, and because they wanted it to... It was Modi and Xi Jinping last year announced it and said, we will make sure that war doesn't turn into, or that conflict doesn't turn into armed conflict between the two of us again, because there are broader things to think about in the world. We need to end it. It was very well put, very well said way back then. And so it's important that we pay attention to these guys. They are important men. Jai Shankar is probably the next prime minister after Modi departs, in my humble opinion. Not that I'm any expert on it, but he's done extremely well on the global stage. Let's see. Landmark event in October 24 when President Xi Jinping and Indian Prime Minister Modi met in Kazan. This meeting marked the beginning of a new phase of engagement. Notably, the positive trajectory of the relationship was not disrupted by the India-Pakistan conflict, which occurred in May, a testament of the growing political will on both sides to deepen their ties, even though China is more associated with Pakistan than with India. And remember, they wouldn't let Pakistan into BRICS because they didn't resolve their dispute with India. And China was for that. They want to make sure that there isn't dispute and that economically they can all get together into BRICS, which is another reason I think BRICS isn't going anywhere, friends and neighbors. Economic interaction also continues to flourish. In 2024, China reclaimed its position as India's top trading partner, surpassing the United States after a two-year hiatus. Bilateral trade reached $118.4 billion, a 4% increase in 2023. These figures underscore a deepening interdependence that provides leverage and incentive for sustained dialogue. And by the way, trade is done in the rupee and the yuan, not exclusively, but getting much closer through the BRICS exchanges. Their national banks are exchanging their currencies between the two of them to the exclusion of the dollar. Important. From Beijing's perspective, the deterioration in relations over the past few years has been abnormal from their point of view. Chinese officials have consistently promoted the idea of improvement across multiple dimensions. India, frequently described in Chinese discourse as a fellow ancient Eastern civilization, and the bilateral relationship has been metaphorically referred to as the dragon-elephant tango, a symbolic framing that seeks to capture the potential harmony between the two powers. China sees India as an indispensable actor in the global south, which is absolutely true. You can't resolve these issues in the global south without India. You can't do it because I'm going to finish this article, and then we might get to that. And advocates for a bilateral relationship that is not directed against any third party mirrors the same language used in reference to China's strategic partnership with Russia. Both China and India promote a vision of a multipolar world, multilateralism, and economic globalization. In this context, parallels have been drawn between Xi's vision of a community with a shared future of mankind and Modi's concept of Vasudeva. Well, it means, I can't say it, but it means the world is one big family, which is rooted in ancient Indian philosophy and emphasizes harmony and interconnectivity. The Chinese-launched Global Civilization Initiative seeks to revive pre-modern cultural framework and plurality of civilization. I like hearing this stuff. When do we ever talk about any of these things? We only talk about how great we are. That's it. We're America. We're great. You're not. Have a nice day. Anyway, this plurality of civilization aligning conceptually with similar trends in India. During the meetings in Beijing, Jaishankar reiterated India's principle of strategic autonomy and independent foreign policy, an approach that resonates with China's own diplomatic posture. He described India and China as development partners rather than rivals, countering dominant Western narrative, there's that word again, that framed China and India relations largely through the lens of competition and threat. China and India are not a threat to us. I hate to say it. I don't think they are. You know, you don't have to agree. Research it yourself. But just, it doesn't seem that way to me. And in fact, it doesn't matter if they are. We're so much smaller than them. And getting smaller, you know, these are going to be the two biggest economies in the world, and they almost already are. If you go purchasing power parity, they're already one and two. Well, no, that's not true. China's number one. U.S. is barely number two, and right behind is India. But they're fast approaching. Triangular dynamic involving U.S. complicates the picture. Current pressure from Washington, particularly the shared risk of a trade war and the volatility of U.S. foreign policy, which is forever up and down. We never know who in the hell's in charge over there. Act as a common concern for New Delhi and Beijing. India, China, and other BRICS nations are facing increased scrutiny from the White House and NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, who have threatened secondary sanctions over continuing economic ties with Russia. These pressures may inadvertently bring India and China closer together because both seek to safeguard their strategic autonomy and development trajectories. And by the way, they won't be told what to do. Historically, the U.S. has sought to exploit gaps between India and China in order to prevent their closer cooperation. That strategy has been less effective in an era where both Beijing and New Delhi are increasingly conscious of the need to define their relationship in their own terms. By the way, without Washington influence, without Lindsey Graham telling them what they need to think. Despite these trends, substantial challenges remain. Chief is the unresolved boundary dispute, which is the most sensitive and complex issue in the bilateral relationship. The Galwan Valley clash in 2020, which resulted in around 24 fatalities, caused a severe deterioration in ties. The June 25 visit of Indian Defense Minister Rajnath Singh to China signaled a renewed willingness to seek a permanent solution. Trade-related frictions persist. India faces restriction on the import of rare earth magnets from China, which are crucial for strategic and industrial sectors. Chinese export controls disrupt Indian manufacturing and deter Chinese foreign direct investment. India restricts Chinese investment, citing national security, and has banned several Chinese apps and conducted raids on some Chinese companies. Geopolitically, the competition for regional influence continues to strain relations. China's growing presence in South Asia and the Indian Ocean clashes with India's strategic interests, specifically in countries like Bhutan, Nepal, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. India has consistently refused to join the Belt and Road Initiative, largely due to its opposition to the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. That's the one with the huge train that is going to go all the way across, and they're fixing all the train rails, which runs through contested territory. Plans for massive infrastructure projects, such as construction of the world's largest dam on the Yarlung Zongbo River, which flows into India, remain points of tension. To move beyond these obstacles, it is essential to build a stable and effective border trust mechanism, restoring strategic dialogue platforms and enhancing multi-level security cooperation are indispensable to creating a mature and resilient bilateral relationship. Tell you what, friends and neighbors, I only tell you all of these things to make sure that you realize that we're not the only folks in the world, and we don't necessarily control it. I want to comment on the likelihood, I suppose, of a Putin and Trump meeting. They're saying it may occur in Beijing. And if there, it would be reasonable to discuss potential talks should the president come to the Chinese capital, said Peskov. Russia says it is ready to discuss talks between Putin and Trump should Trump attend the commemorative events in Beijing in September. The Chinese capital is going to host a military parade on September 3rd, to mark the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II, and Putin has accepted an invitation to attend. Speculation is growing over a possible meeting between Putin, Trump, and Xi Jinping. And I tell you what, the three most important world leaders meeting together, hey man, I'm all for it. Maybe they could get something accomplished. Wouldn't that be nice? Japan's Kyoto News reported that the Chinese government has decided to invite Trump, and the Times suggests that Beijing is positioning itself to host a trilateral summit. If it happens that Trump is there, then of course we will not rule out the question of the expediency of holding a meeting, said Peskov on Monday, noting that the Kremlin has not heard whether Trump is going to attend. The day before, the Kremlin spokesman said that although a meeting between the two would definitely happen in the future, it would require a lot of preparation, and the time has not yet come. The speculation followed a phone call between Trump and Xi Jinping in June, during which the president said he had been invited to visit China. Putin and Trump have spoken by phone multiple times in recent months, focusing on the Ukraine conflict. So maybe it would be something useful. Maybe it would actually work out. The Kremlin has nothing more to say about the potential meeting, except that, you know, it's the commemoration of the 80th. We know nothing about the possibilities of such a meeting, said Peskov. And, you know, where's his other quotes that were pretty funny? Analysts quote the London Times that the anniversary could offer a symbolic platform for the powers to engage in dialogue amid worsening global tensions. The paper further claimed that Beijing had tacitly encouraged speculation on the subject by refusing to deny them. So if you refuse to deny something, does that necessarily make it true? Oh, goodness, I've refused to deny a lot of things. Does that mean I'm guilty? Oh, boy. Chinese scholar Jin Kanrong told Guancha, a news outlet, that a joint appearance by Xi, Putin, and Trump at a military parade would send a powerful message to the world. Wouldn't that be interesting? While Trump has publicly pushed for a resolution of the Ukraine conflict and re-engaged with Russian leadership since returning to office, frustration is growing over the stalled negotiations. Now, let me speculate here for a minute, because that's what I do. It's what I live for. I get to speculate. Assume that the news comes out next week that, oh, yes, indeed, the old Trumpster has been invited to come to the military parade and sit next to Xi Jinping and Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin. What do you think is going to happen? The next thing here would be my prediction. That the Z-Man, the old Green Goblin, jumps up and says, I'm in. I get to go. I want to be there. You can't meet without me. You guys are going to settle the Ukraine conflict without me. Well, the Ukraine conflict has very little to do with Ukraine. It has a lot to do with America and Russia and the West. And if anybody's going to resolve it, it'll be Xi Jinping, Vladimir Vladimirovich, and Donald Jayevich Trump. And that might actually have a possibility of occurring. And it could be a lot of fun to see something like that. I would like to see somebody recognize from the West that, oh, by the way, Japan and China had millions that died in World War II as well. And Japan was on no picnic in China when it was destroying them. And, you know, it's a big holiday. It's a big resolution. So I don't know. I would like to see it. But no, Russia is always canceled. We still have the cancel culture. If you say something negative, you must be in the cancel culture. And they're still doing it. Sports figures from Russia are being denied participation under their own flag. They have to choose the flag of another country. There was a guy with a Russian tattoo. He had a Russian flag tattooed because he's from Russia, right? But he couldn't wear a flag. And so there was discussion about him not being able to participate because he had a Russian flag tattoo. Nonsense. Oh, what a bunch of crap. He's a swimmer. And what if you're in the Navy? I mean, doesn't everybody have a flag from the Navy? And then a star Russian conductor had his concert in Italy canceled because Brussels and Ukraine supporters scrapped the performance. So now you can't even be a conductor of an orchestra. Nonsense. So a concert in Italy by renowned Russian conductor Valery Georgiev has been canceled following pressure from Brussels and supporters of Ukraine. Georgiev, one of Russia's most acclaimed musicians, was supposed to perform at the Una Estata del Rey festival and Caserta on July 27 with the Philharmonic Orchestra of Salerno. But on Monday, the Royal Palace management announced the cancellation. No reason was given, but the move followed backlash from EU officials, Ukrainian communities, and Kyiv supporters after the concert was announced. Italian cultural minister welcomed the decision to cancel the performance, saying it reflected common sense and moral responsibility aimed at protecting the values of the free world. Well, that presumes that the values you're trying to impose upon others are those that, you know, people should support. Last month, European Parliament called for him to be replaced in the concert. A number of other officials have canceled others. Should we cancel all musicians, conductors, sopranos, athletes, sportsmen? This is absurd and intolerable. Do you really think that these demagogic attitudes help build peace? It's exactly the opposite. Discrimination does not serve peace. The best way to open a dialogue to bring us closer to peace is to bring people together and not set up walls. Georgiev has not yet commented. He's among numerous Russian artists' performances in the West that have been canceled. Another one, Russian ballerina performance canceled in Seoul. Isn't that nutty? A series of shows featuring the Bolshoi Theater's principal dancer suspended amidst Kyiv's protest. So Kyiv protests, they cancel your shows. Her name is Svetlana Zakharova, renowned ballerina from Russia's Bolshoi Ballet. After Ukraine expressed anger over the events, the set of shows featuring Zakharova has been scheduled to take place at Seoul Arts Center in April, but it was canceled. So this is ongoing and continual, that they just, anything Russian, anything is evil, right? Nonsense, friends and neighbors. Okay, let's go to the anti-corruption that I promised to try to get to by the end. Vladimir Zelensky is cracking down on opponents and figures previously supported by Western funding. Investigators from the National Anti-Corruption Bureau have been subjected to raids by security, allegedly without court warrant. Well, that doesn't stop you if your name's Vladimir Zelensky. Come on! NABU, which is tasked with investigating top-level corruption, reported the incidents as tensions allegedly grow between Vladimir Zelensky's administration and his political opponents. The Ukrainian parliament, where Zelensky's party holds a slim majority, formed a committee earlier this month to examine anti-corruption. Local media first reported searches, citing sources with law enforcement who said several anti-corruption officers are suspected of collaborating with Russia and Ukrainian oligarchs. The Security Service of Ukraine subsequently made accusations against senior officials and accused them of having ties with Russia. Oh my God. Zelensky is becoming more authoritarian. That's coming about. He is currently dismantling the system of control on which the U.S. and Europe spent a lot of effort and money, because he's going to stay in power. He isn't going anywhere voluntarily ever. There's stories about people trying to off him, both in MI6 and in the CIA. These stories are coming out, and I read a few of them over the last few days. And, excuse me. And it seems like they have a lot of potential truth to them. Let's put it that way. I think that the war is going to continue until they get rid of the Z-Man. And whether that is going to be voluntary or not, nobody knows. But either way, people are saying he's becoming more and more authoritarian. Recent raids and cabinet reshuffles are, you know, they're continuing. He's facing growing accusations of authoritarianism. This is Financial Times reporting. They cite many opposition politicians, civil society leaders, and diplomats as stating it and suffering from the consequences of so saying, that he is attempting to sideline critics, muzzle civil society leaders, and consolidate his own control. Masked operatives recently raided the homes of prominent anti-corruption activists. The raids followed sanctions against several high-profile politicians, including former President Pyotr Poroshenko, longtime political rival who lost to him in 2019 and is a big critic. But that is, you know, that those will continue. And he jails, he sends people to arrest them. They all get locked up. You can't go to church. You know, they're all kinds of stuff. Concerns about authoritarianism have been raised in Western press as well. Economist reports that government in Kiev has become entangled in palace politics, as they call it, with internal purges and infighting threatening to fracture the state from within. And that, my friends and neighbors and countrymen, is that for today. I think there has been plenty of discussion of these topics, and much more will be there to follow. I would like to encourage you, of course, to listen to damradio.com as often as possible. damradio.com/live to get music at any time, and to listen to our full schedule of talk hosts, you can go to damradio.com/schedule and get the complete schedule. My program is called International Flavor. It is on nightly from 9 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. You can always go to damradio.com/podcasts and get all former shows that are played on damradio.com. You can go to internationalflavor.com and listen to all of my back programs. And I do hope that you do. It is, there are plenty of them out there. And I think I am approaching the 150 episodes. I hope that you continue to listen to us and join us again tomorrow.